Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Kantz v. Hood.
This probate case presents two issues for review. The first concerns the independence of the executor, and the second, his ability to recover his fees and costs following a successful defense of the lawsuit to remove him. At the core of both of these issues is the state's longstanding policy of defending the independence of the executor under Section 145 of the Probate Code. Both from those who ask the court to control the executor and from an executor who seeks to surrender his authority to the court, because it's the separation of the courts from the executor that make independent administration in Texas so unique. Now, before the code was amended to allow an independent executor to be removed for cause, the district court, acting in equity, had the ability to appoint a receiver over estate assets. Now, since 1979, the ability to appoint a receiver is no longer quite as important because Section 149C now allows the court to remove an executor. In this case, however, the trial court not only appointed a receiver over certain estate assets, the last estate asset, the family farm, but it continued to exclude the executor from control over those assets by directing the district clerk then to distribute the proceeds of the receiver's sale. Now, the 10th Court held that that was harmless error. But we know it was error because that form of control has never been approved by a trial court. The interference with the executor in this case is more extreme than what this court saw in DeYounger versus DePena. In that case, the trial court simply withheld funds that were placed in the trial court's register, and this court granted mandamus to correct that error. In Collins versus Baker, the 14th Court held that a trial court's order directing a clerk to distribute funds was void because there was no statute which specifically and explicitly allowed the trial court to interfere with that executor's duties. The question then, we know this is error, the question is, can it be harmless? And Justice Gray, in the 10th Court's opinion, dissent, said that the order in this case to the clerk was made without jurisdiction, and it was void. Now, I'm not sure that using the term jurisdiction or jurisdictional is very prudent in this situation, but the judge's order was certainly without any statutory authority, and in that sense, it was void or voidable. And from a policy standpoint...
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
The funds from the sale of the farm were in the registry of the court because the court appointed receiver deposited them there after the sale. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And whether the appointment of the receiver was right or wrong was litigated in the first appeal.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
But, and so that judgment became final and the court held that that appointment of the receiver was all right.
Yes, sir.
So we have a duly appointed receiver who carries out his or her duties, sells the money, and what is the ordinary course of action of a receiver when they sell property under a court order?
Normally, it's to deposit the funds back into the register.
Which is exactly what happened here.
That's correct.
Is your argument that the court, trial court, had absolutely no jurisdiction to order dispersal of funds within its own custody?
Yes, sir, in this sense. The only discretion the court had, in our opinion, is to direct those funds to be delivered to the executive.
Already having found and a finding of fact that the executor had grossly managed the estate?
That's the irony of the case, Your Honor. We have an executor who's still in authority.
Well, aren't there cases that hold that you don't have to remove the executor before you can, under these circumstances?
Yes, sir. Now, the question is, how far can the trial court go?
well, you don't complain on behalf of your client that how they were distributed was unfair or improper or didn't give any beneficiary what they were entitled to under an accounting.
That's correct,
Your Honor. No complaint about that, which is the basis for the Court of Appeals finding no harm.
Yes, sir.
What is the real basis of your argument? Merely that there is, quote, no authority to interfere with an independent executor who's still there under the prior court order.
That's the policy consideration. The harm now comes from the fact that this executor, who's still in power, has no way to close the estate administration.
What about if he says, I'm still serving, I now want to close, all the assets have been distributed, there's nothing left here, and I'll just go back to the probate court or the county court in this case, or the district court, if I understand everything was transferred to the district court, and say,
yes,
here's the facts, Judge, give me an order discharging me.
Well, he could do that, but he has to do it at his own expense, out of his own pocket. And the code doesn't require that an executor do that.
That's the sole basis for his complaint, that he has the right to close, which is what you say he wants, but it would be at his cost instead of the estate's cost.
Essentially, yes.
And how much, on a simple estate with no assets left, what type of cost are we talking about?
Certainly not substantial.
As opposed to appealing to the Supreme Court.
Well, that's correct, yes, sir. And so there are two considerations here. One is the policy of the state of protecting the office of the independent executor, and the second is...
Well, is it really a correct statement now under the way the probate code scheme exists that the court system has absolutely no supervision of an independent executor?
Well, sir, I think the newest series of amendments to the code, the 149 ABCDE, that series give a trial court more authority, certainly than it has.
Well, it gives interested parties, beneficiaries, et cetera, the right to demand accountings,
yes,
the right to demand distributions, which is what was asked for by the heirs in this case at the outset. Is that correct?
That's correct. Actually, Your Honor, one of the requests that was made by these beneficiaries was under 149B. And in my opinion, at least, if the court had gone with the remedies under 149B, we wouldn't be here. The second issue is somewhat related to the first, and it has to do with the fees and costs of the executive.
May I ask you a question about that, too? See whether you agree or disagree. The Court of Appeals, in the majority opinion, stated that the issue that you raised in the appeal is that the trial court denied your request for attorney's fees were against the facts. Finding the facts were against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. Was that your claim?
Yes, sir. We made that
I mean,
claim.
That was your issue in the trial court. And that's what they decided. I mean, in the Court of Appeals.
Court of Appeals, yes, sir.
Is what you're saying to us today different from that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. What we're complaining about today is the 10th
Court.
Yes, sir. What we're complaining about today is the 10th Court's treatment and how it reviewed the evidence in order to reach the answer to that very question. Under the code, there is no distinction made between an executor who has mismanaged an estate, embezzled from the estate, or even been sentenced to the penitentiary. There's no difference between that vile executor and one who's merely failed to file a notice or file an accounting. All of them are subject to removal, and all of them also qualify for reimbursement of their costs and fees if they conduct a good faith defense. The focus of the subsection and our problem state, but the conduct of the defense. And that's where the error came from. The trial court found all sorts of problems with this executive. Things that he had failed to do, things that he had done in relation to the title to the family farm. It characterized that as misconduct or mismanagement. But when it came to the defense of the removal action, the trial court only did two things. And the first thing was it did not remove the executive.
Well, let me ask you this. Can the trial court, 149C says that the trial court may remove the independent executor. It's discretionary.
Yes.
And so let's say you look down to subsection 4, he fails to timely file the notice required by 128A. If the notice has not been timely filed, can the trial court not remove him but order him to file it? Or would you say, under your argument, the court would have no jurisdiction to do that? The court can only remove the executor or not remove the executor.
The trial court, this executive has done these things, please remove him, then the court can say only, we remove him or we don't.
No choice. The court cannot order him, say, I'm not going to remove you, but you're ordered to file what you're required to file under subsection 4 within 30 days.
If the action is only under 149C, if it's under 149E, however, there are other orders that the trial court can make. The trial court has a number of things it can do. In this case, it just failed to do the right one. The trial court could leave the executor in place under 145 and leave him alone. He could leave the executor in place and order him to distribute under 149B. He could remove the executor and dispose of the asset under 149C. With subsection B, or he could remove him and appoint a new executive to do the job. This trial court did none of those. He left him in place, but then usurped his power, and that's the problem.
Why?
I'm sorry.
Why?
Why?
You got any idea why?
No. I speculate that the judge was merely trying to achieve a result. Saw that the fastest route from here to there was to do it himself.
But to the beneficiaries, it makes no difference how the trial judge accomplished this.
That's right.
So your case is really millions for defense. It's millions for principal, essentially.
Well,
because in another case, it might make a difference if the independent executor is weakened.
This is a real policy case, John. The court's got to decide. If the policy under the probate code of leaving an independent executor independent is what we still intend to do. And that has been such a strong policy in the probate code. It is what makes Texas independent administration unique. It was designed to be simple. It was designed to be inexpensive. And it's that way only because the executor is protected from interference by the court.
In this case, there's a family farm, so I guess it's a family business that's involved here.
Essentially.
And if this were not an independent executor, if this was just, the person to whom the responsibility was given in the will to run the business on behalf of the family, you'd have no difficulty with the trial court, based on the proper pleadings, appointing a receiver to oversee the operation of the business.
If this were not an independent administration, that's true.
And no matter what the assigned responsibility by contract or by will to this person that's running this business, by the appointment of the receiver, the trial court could care less about who is the ostensible responsible party or the person who's been assigned this by contract. The receiver now takes over the business. And there's no, the judge at that point doesn't need to remove the owner or the operator or anything else. It's just the receiver now takes over and the operator just sits at the sidelines.
Well, as to that particular piece of property, yes.
So except for the fact that this is an independent executor, under the probate code, the trial court doesn't necessarily have, is not necessarily treating this independent executor any other way than he'd treat any other owner of a business who's been shunted aside once he's appointed a receiver.
And that's the unfortunate thing, Judge, because this was an act, and he was entitled to protection in that office under the probate code.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Gregory Johnson will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Addressing first the issue regarding the distribution of the funds by the clerk, I believe that the 10th Court addressed the fact that it was appropriate and it was well settled that the court had the power to appoint a receiver, and as opposed to the way that the petitioner in this matter looks at it, it's our position that the distribution was just the outcome of the receivership. That when the court said, okay, here I'm going to appoint this receiver, we're going to hold the money in the registry of the court in case there's any type of claims that the court's going to have to rule over, which the court did. And at that point, once those are done, the money will be distributed just exactly the same way as it should have been done under the will.
But as I understand Mr. Robertson's argument, the court had no power to appoint a receiver unless it removed the independent executor.
Well, and as the question was asked, that was an issue that was that Mr. Robertson brought in the 10th Court of Appeals about the fact that they could not, there should not have been a receiver appointed. The 10th Court found that there had been, and that was the final judgment in this case, that it wasn't appropriate for a receiver to be appointed. I believe it's correct, and I believe what Mr. Robertson did is correct, that this would be a lot easier if the court had made the additional step of also removing the independent executor.
But he refused to do so, right?
Excuse me?
The trial court was asked to do that, and he refused to do it.
That's my understanding, that is correct. And
why would he do that and then just take over the independent executor job?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. That's exactly why he did that. I came into the case after that point and was not involved in those decisions, etc. However, it's clear that this is the way that the court said, I know I have the ability to appoint a receiver. One asset left. I can appoint a receiver to get rid of that asset. He appointed the receiver sold the asset, the money was distributed, and everybody came out exactly the same. As far as the court's harm analysis, their objection to it is simply that there's this estate and they could dispose of the estate, but that ignores the fact that there's no assets in this estate. It ignores the fact that there's no requirement that any closing affidavit be filed. There's no responsibilities for this executor. This estate is done and over with. There's no reason for anything to happen, and that's exactly what the trial court was faced with. The trial court thought it did everything that it had to do by getting this property sold and the money spread out, and thought, you know, there's no reason to remove an executor because I'm taking care of this one piece of property and everything else.
There might be harm if the independent executor is entitled to fees for the defense of the attempt to remove him from the position.
Well,
maybe it's just $50 or $100 to close the estate out, and we would say de minimis. But the petitioner's claim is that there's a lot more than that involved.
Yes, I understand that. If that was the case, and there's not any claim that that there was any harm in how the money was distributed, other than the fact that they claimed that the administrator was entitled to recover his fees. And as I stated at the beginning, that it's our position that that was just part of the receivership's action to begin with. That there was one asset was left. The court said we're going to get rid of this by this receivership, and as soon as that money has come in, anybody makes a claim they want, and then it's going to be distributed out. And it makes no difference. There's not any way for the court to determine or any way that anything could have been different if both parties made their claim to the court for recovery from this fund. Whether or not the money was in the hands of the independent executor or the district clerk, the court made the ruling that it made and said, here, you know, here's what belongs to you, here's what belongs to you, here's what belongs to you. That would make no difference whether it was done by the district clerk or if the receiver himself had done it or if the independent executor had had to do that. With regard to the question of the attorney fees in good faith, there was a specific finding, and that's the key under 149C of whether or not the defense was in good faith. There was a specific finding by the trial court.
Well, we're not reviewing that issue here, right? I mean, the Court of Appeals reviewed that for factual insufficiency, but that issue's not before us.
Well, I believe that the question that Mr. Robertson has raised is whether or not, looking for his exact, whether or not he was entitled to the recovery of his attorney fees. And that hinged exactly on the question of defense in good faith.
But again, can we hear that? I mean, we have no jurisdiction over factual sufficiency, and we're not here to weigh the evidence on that point, are we?
Well, I think that's exactly what Mr. Roberts is asking you to do in making the determination about whether or not the independent executor was entitled to the recovery of his attorney. Taking the position that if he's not actually removed, then his defense must have been in good faith. And if you, as he noted, he stated that the analysis by the 10th Court of Appeals was incorrect because they kept referring to things he did wrong during his management of the estate, but didn't refer to things that were wrong with his defense. Or that was his position. But that's how they, that their review of those matters were incorrect. The court did make a specific finding that the defense was not in good faith. And
how can that be if you win?
Well, that's our essential difference between...
I think you're in bad faith, but you win. I mean, what kind of a ruling is that?
That's the essential difference between the first, from the very beginning, what Mr. Roberts stated, what our position is. They did not win. The executor did not win. The court went a different direction with removing, with getting rid of this asset. Instead of actually removing him, we went a different direction and actually appointed a receiver. As the 10th Court, in their opinion, stated, they were quoted two cases, I believe the O'Connor case and the Medding case, and they stated that at that point, to go ahead and remove the independent executor would be duplicative and unnecessary. So, I mean, that's exactly what anybody who read the trial court's order and seen what trial court judge in the in that case, no one would ever say that they won. Say that he was not actually removed. To me, I mean, I have no idea why the court did it, but to me it was just an oversight. But to say that they won was certainly an incorrect statement, because the independent executor thought he had done whatever he needed to do and was done with it. The court took a completely different view, said you've mismanaged this, and I'm going to take it over and I'm going to appoint a receiver to take care of this. And so that's exactly what the court did in making that fine. Now, with regard...
Do you think the Court of Appeals opinion could be used by courts and parties to justify judicial interference with the job of the independent executor in other instances where it comes out all right?
The only thing that I think that, only with regard to the harm analysis, and I guess that could apply to any case, where regard to say, well, if everybody turns out exactly the same, then what exactly are we here arguing about? But that's going to apply in any case, whether it's a probate case or any other case, where you're talking about that you have to make a harm analysis. However, what's important in this case is that you still have the equitable powers of a trial court. This court had the equitable powers to appoint a receiver. And once that had been done, there are different rules that apply, et cetera, as to other than exactly what's in the probate code. And because it took that unusual step, it made this a different case than probably most any case that would appear before other trial courts. And I don't think that they would be able to look at this unless they had those particular facts that were receivables. I believe that this case with regard to the attorney fees, there's not any question. The court made the finding that they did. I think that there's not any, although there's not a great deal of evidence, nothing in the opinion with regard to what evidence that they weighed, other than the fact that the things that they looked at with regard to what the trial court inferred with regard to the mismanagement of the estate, and those things were listed out. And that's explicitly what the trial court found was, look, I found all these things that you did very, very wrong. You didn't even try and defend those. The transcript shows that very well, that the record is barren of him attempting to defend his not doing what he needed to do to manage the estate. And that's essentially what the trial court said. Look, if you're not even going to try and defend what you did, I'm not going to find that that's in good faith. In fact, I'm going to find it's not in good faith. I'm going to find that it's not in good faith. Once that finding is made, that's the end of the story. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May I please report? Mr. Bob Robertson will remember that over the commission.
Justice Baker, I would like to expand on the answer to the question, although you asked if we have raised the great weight and preponderance issue in the Court of Appeals, and I hope I didn't, by my answer, exclude other complaints that we made. And one of those was the question of, what, since the executor was not removed in this case, was he entitled to reimbursement of his fees and expenses as a matter of law? We also addressed that issue in the Court of Appeals. If that makes a difference to your consideration of that particular point in this court. I also want to talk about the fact that there was no good faith finding for the executor by the trial court. And I don't believe that that injures this executor's position in this court. Based on this court's decision in Miller versus Anderson. In that case, of course, the question was whether the attorney for the executive was entitled to his attorney's fees for his trial to have the will admitted to probate. That's under a different section, 243.
Well, let me ask you about that.
Yes, sir.
You state on your brief, pages 6 and 7, I think this is your argument. The trial court did not specifically find the executor's defense either in bad faith or not in good faith. Instead, the court found that his attempting to defend his own gross misconduct and gross mismanagement is not an action taken in good faith. So that's a quote from your brief, is that right? And the Court of Appeals said that the trial court expressly held that he did not defend the removal action in good faith. I presume that they were talking about what you just quoted, is that right?
Yes, sir, that's the same. It's the same finding, and I think you'll just have to look at the court's findings of fact, which are, of course, in the record, to see how that was worded.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
On attorney's fees in this court, you structure this argument pretty much as a legal point.
Yes.
The Court of Appeals treats that solely as a zero attorney's fees, which Kat said was against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. Did your Court of Appeals, your brief to the Court of Appeals, treat this as a legal point as well?
Yes, sir, and that's what I was trying to point out to Justice Baker. It did address both points, a matter of law and sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, am I correct? Your argument is he was entitled to attorney's fees as a matter of law because he wasn't removed as the independent executor.
Yes, sir. And we're also saying that the finding of the trial court is not a finding of bad faith. What the trial court found, and you'll have to read the record very carefully, was that his attempt to defend was not an act in good faith. And I don't want to be dancing on the head of a pin here, but attempting to defend a removable act cannot by itself be in bad faith. And that's because even an unsuccessful defense can qualify for reimbursement under the statute.
But you have to get some findings as a legal predicate to the to your attorney's fees, don't you? And a finding more than a negative. I mean, you would need a finding of good faith, would you not?
And that's what I'm trying to point out to the court. That lack of a good faith finding does not injure our position because of this court's opinion in Miller versus Anderson. And again, that was under a different section, but the court found that under that section, under 243, that the admission of the will to probate was itself a finding that the action was taken in good faith. And I think the same logic applies in this case. We don't presume that someone who's been hailed into court as a defendant appears there in bad faith. We just don't do it. Rule 13 says the pleadings are presumed to have been filed in good faith, so that someone who appears in court and wins the lawsuit, that is not removed, you can't begin with the presumption that he's in good faith, he wins the lawsuit, and now is in bad faith. It doesn't make possible.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second case. We'll take another brief recess.
Yeah, please rise.